I love a brighter smile. What I don't love is that little wince when I take a sip of something cold or even breathe in cold air. You know that feeling that takes your breath away, that ouch, eek. That's why I like Sensodyne Clinical White. Its triple action formula whitens, polishes, and helps protect against sensitivity. Plus, it protects against new stains for up to 6 months. So I can keep enjoying my iced coffee and everything else I love without the sensitivity. Whiter teeth without the wince. Try Sensodyne Clinical White today.
Cha-ching! That's the sound of Lowe's Labor Day savings. Get up to 45% off select major appliances and save up to an additional $100 on select laundry pairs. Plus, get 3 bags of Miracle-Gro 0.75 cubic foot garden soil for just $10. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in-store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. See Lowe's.com for more details. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
What Came Next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwasWrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening.
Kate Johnson is a survivor, writer, poet, and occasional humorist whose work explores the process of deconstructing the evangelical beliefs and structures in which she was raised. A wordsmith who has also lived with a parent on the sex offender registry, Johnson shares about the impact of her trauma, shame, grief, and estrangement. Her goal is to offer people inspiration and awareness amidst their own personal deconstruction process. The Broken Cycle Media team is incredibly appreciative of Kate's energy, time, advocacy, and her willingness to discuss hard truths in order to help ease others' trauma and lift their shame.
I'm Kate Johnson, and always introduce myself as a bi pastor's daughter. I am a survivor and also someone who has lived with a parent on the sex offender registry. I'm also a writer, and my work explores trauma, shame, silence, grief from estrangement. As a survivor advocate, I write to help others feel less alone so they can reclaim their voice, their self-trust, and their creative joy. I grew up as a pastor's daughter in the PCA Church. And for those of you who don't know, the PCA Church is the Presbyterian Church of America. A lot of really lovely people in the church. They also are believers in Calvinism and total depravity. Total depravity means you are born a little sinner, and only through God can you be redeemed and made good. I grew up in the PCA Church in the late 90s and early 2000s. It was kind of at the tail end of the Satanic Panic era, the Family's Values era. The thing that I remember the most from that era is that there was a lot of things culturally where if you followed the rules, then you would be safe. But the rules were always kind of arbitrary and they could change at any time. There was a lot of fear around Harry Potter, Pokemon, all these different things that could be like corrupting forces in your home. But the rules themselves also extended to what was allowed in the house. I think the first time that I encountered that is when I had my first spanking experience. During the 90s, there was a lot of parenting books that really reinforced this idea of corporal punishment and spanking. I remember I was playing on my dad's CDs, The Floor is Lava, jumping on the CDs, and he had told me not to. After he told me again, that's when I got spanked. And I remember having my pants pulled down and experiencing such shame in that moment. and the realization that I didn't do something bad, that I was bad. And also the realization that the people who love me could be the people who hurt me, because one of the ways that you were supposed to do aftercare with your kids, basically, is you hug them after and you told them that you love them. I think for a lot of kids who experience spanking during that time, whether they grew up in the church or not, it really gave a lot of kids a deeply ingrained sense of perfectionism, because suddenly you were presented with this idea that if you stepped out of line, then you were bad. Trying to do the right thing all the time, the stakes were high. It was like, oh no, I'm going to go to hell. There was no in the middle. I think another realization from that was a really important part of my story, is realizing that my body was not my own and it belonged to my parents. Because there was this idea that at the time of parental authority within the church, God is at the top, and then the church and your pastors and that sort of thing. And then you have the father and the mother, and the children are at the very bottom. And each one is supposed to submit to one another. The man has to be seen as the head of the house and also be a good example in the church when they're a pastor. So if you were seen as you can't control your kids, then that reflected badly on your father, even if you were just a little kid and you were going through normal little kid things. I have 3 siblings, so I am the eldest daughter. I have a sister younger than me, and then another sister below that, and then my youngest brother is 8 years younger than I am. I just remember feeling very protective over my siblings in general, and that plays a huge part of my story as well. Church was our whole lives. We were going to Sunday school, we were going to service. We learned really young age to sit in the pews and not wiggle too much. Spending time learning to read our Bibles. All my friends and the community were in my church. We were also homeschooled. I think a lot of people think homeschoolers are really isolated. That was never the case for us. Like, we had homeschool groups. We did a Christian homeschool curriculum. It was basically pretty much every activity, art class to choir to field trips, was within the church. My first day of kindergarten was 9/11. We lived in Annapolis, Maryland at the time. So we were right next to the Naval Academy in Washington, D.C. So there was literally planes flying over our heads. And that was actually the reason that was my first day of kindergarten, because we got all my homeschool books earlier. And my mom, she plopped the books on the table because she just needed something regulating as the planes were flying overhead. And it was so pivotal, because there was really a big shift in the church at that time, where I had already noticed the fear before, but just that feeling of, okay, everything inside is safe, to we could be attacked. There was a lot of nationalism after that time. I was with my dad, and I remember him just having a conversation about the terrorist with me, and just that becoming such a conversation in the church. The tone of that conversation at the time was, these bad people, the terrorists, are attacking us, and we have to fight back as America. And I think there was a lot of, like, burgeoning Islamophobia during that time. My dad was a youth pastor in the Presbyterian church, so his main job was to teach basically anyone in their teenage years. It was to bring kids in the area to the church to mentor them. He did a lot of different sorts of camps that had really fun themes. He was always doing silly skits, having a funny costume on. I grew up going to a lot of retreats and always being surrounded by these kids who are almost like big brothers and sisters to me during that time. Understanding where the youth pastor is in the hierarchy is kind of probably a lower position. The pastor hierarchy still plays a really important role, but you usually have a senior pastor or maybe two above him who preaches regularly on Sundays. And then my dad preached every once in a while for like the big church, but his ministry preaching was focused mainly towards the youth.
Carrying us forward, at the age of 9, everything would shift with your father's first arrest in 2005. Can you walk us through what you remember of the events and how they immediately impacted your family and you personally?
Yeah, so it was March 2005 when he was arrested. My mom had told me the day before that we could have a sleepover that night. So I was really excited about having a sleepover at my friend's house. And the reason why that sleepover happened would become evident later. But when my mom picked me up the next morning, she took me to our house and a bunch of their friends, and my dad was there. They told us that my dad had been arrested, but at the time we couldn't even be told what the crime was, but it was for child sexual abuse material. I remember them telling us that it had something to do with computers and that dad would be going away. And I remember in that moment, my dad asking for forgiveness before we had even had time to process it. And I did give that forgiveness to him during that moment, but not really having an understanding of what was going to happen. The thing that I said after that to him was, make sure you told people about Jesus in prison. And that was really what I've been taught my whole life, is there's the good people like us and there's the bad people in prison. But my dad is a good person, so he needs to tell them about Jesus, so the people in prison will be redeemed, but not quite putting those two things together.
What were the actual conviction, and then what was his sentence?
Sexual exploitation of a minor, second degree. What happened, from my understanding, it was basically him chatting with minors online who were boys, exchanging explicit photos with them. It was called child pornography at the time, which is not what it is. It's child sexual abuse material. He had his first court procedures and pled guilty. Then he was placed on house arrest. It was at least a year. It was a bit fuzzy during that time because I was 9 years old and I was going through this. I would say that our worlds exploded during that time. We really lost a lot of our church community for a variety of reasons I don't want to get too much into, because that's her story. My mom decided to stay. I will say that there is a pressure within the church to really stay with your husband no matter what and support them. And that's part of that hierarchical system that I was describing before. I think it's also just hard societally for women to have the safety and stability to be able to leave. All the advice at the time was really pushing, if you want stability for your kids, you shouldn't divorce, even though it was exchanging explicit information with minors online. It was really framed as a pornography addiction within the church, which was absolutely not what it was. It was a minimization. But it was really framed as an addiction that could be overcome. We couldn't live with my dad when he was on house arrest. So it was pretty much my mom taking care of four kids. So it was a lot of pressure. I know at some point I was able to only speak with him on the phone. Eventually, we were able to have supervised in-person meetings. But I just remember during that time that it was just very hard for my mom, who was facing all this pressure from the church and the fallout and really taking a lot of that on. And at the same time, also facing pressure of child protective services, social services, and that sort of thing that she had to fight for and protect her kids. And during that time, CPS came and social services came and checked things out. They determined that we could stay with our parents. But in those 15 years, they had someone that came by and checked that my dad was still living there. My dad was not there one time. It was always my mom who said that he still lives here. And it was just a verbal agreement, but no one checked on the kids during that time. I remember just feeling such profound shame as a kid. We also had friends that didn't stick around. And I understand why their parents probably didn't want them to play with us. But as a kid, you absorb, I am bad. Not my dad did a bad thing. That can be really isolating for a kid and really keep them silent.
Hey, this is Kevin.
This is Joe.
And Nick Jonas from Hey Jonas. This episode of Hey Jonas is brought to you by the all-new drink lineup at McDonald's.
I don't have to tell you that there are already so many great drink options at McDonald's, but the new drink lineup, I mean, it takes things to another level.
They've got delicious caffeinated refreshers like the Strawberry Watermelon Refresher, crafted sodas like the Sprite Berry Blast, and now the all-new Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer.
We're talking about a total game changer. It's made with Red Bull. It's mixed with blue raspberry flavor and topped with freeze-dried dragon fruit.
Wow.
McDonald's has given us a refreshing new boost for your day.
And the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer is arriving just as you're heading back to the dorms for the fall semester. It's got a boost of energy and a kick of flavor when you need it the most. You know, powering through those lectures and studying sessions, you're going to need it. Kicking the afternoon slump or rallying for the weekend.
Try one of the many new drinks like the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer, also available with Red Bull Zero, now at McDonald's.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
You know when people try a new food and suddenly it's like, wait.
That's the reaction a lot of people are having when they first try Kewpie Mayo.
It's the one with the red cap and the little baby on the bottle. You've probably seen it in the grocery store before.
And if you've ever just walked past it, some people would say that's a huge mistake.
Because this mayo is different.
Most mayonnaise uses whole eggs. Kewpie only uses egg yolks, which gives it this rich umami flavor. It's smoother, deeper, and almost buttery.
Once people try it, they start putting it on everything.
Egg sandwiches, fries, burgers. Some fans even swear by dipping pizza crust in it.
And once you notice it, you start seeing it everywhere.
Chefs use it. Restaurants use it. People who really care about flavor use it.
Never tried it? Grab the bottle with the red cap next time you're at the store.
Put it on just about anything.
Then you'll understand.
Kewpie, the original Japanese mayonnaise.
Later, he was sentenced to 5 years of probation. He had to register once he officially went on probation. There was a lot of different rules on the registry. I don't think I realized the impact that it would have of being a child in that house and your address basically being public. And there is a disclaimer that you can't harass anyone, but we would sometimes get random notes from people. Several neighbors wanted our landlord to end the lease so that we wouldn't be living there. There was this constant fear in my life. My nervous system was always in high alert. If my dad does something wrong, then he could be taken away again. My dad was trying to bring us together around this. Everyone is against us, but we're all together as a family and we can make it through this together. I think that's the dangerous thing about when you feel rejected by a community like the church. It really gives this person who's been shown that they're unsafe a platform to really create an insulated environment where that abuse can continue. We were homeschooled during this time where we'd have to do a chore every day of the week. So like Monday, it was the whole family of six's laundry. On Friday, it was like clean and vacuum the whole car. But they were like age inappropriate chores where it was very overwhelming. I learned language for it later, but that's called parentification. And it often happens in volatile situations like that. And in addition to that, there was also an aspect of if you speak out against that, then you are rebelling. So you really don't have a voice in that situation. And if you tell anyone else about it, then your whole world could explode again. So it can be very isolating. Another part of that that I think is really important to highlight is there was also financial troubles during that time. But my dad did not want to accept food assistance, even though we qualified during that time. Over the course of the 15 years that we lived on the registry, that we experienced on and off food insecurity, which not only impacts you short term, but also long term as well. We couldn't move from our home because there were so many housing regulations to move to a cheaper place. It was difficult to find a place that would take us. For a while, like my dad couldn't even go to church and just having worship with my dad at a home church. I remember that being deeply isolating for us, just constant fear and anxiety all the time. He'd take my sister and I out. I think it started when I was in sixth grade and he was allowed to be alone with us. My dad started a landscaping company. He'd take us out and we'd rake mulch for his business. When I was in the car alone with him, he'd treat me as a family therapist. And then when I did have money, he'd ask, can I use that money for Christmas presents for your siblings to help pay for rent, for groceries? And I wanted to be good. But he really isolated me in that situation and then praised me afterwards. For someone living in that situation where your parents are more focused on each other and the house and keeping things stable, I ate that up. I need that praise. I need that self-esteem. Probably starting around middle school, I was introduced to this concept of purity culture, like save yourself until marriage. The way that it was framed is if you saved your sexual purity, including your first kiss, until marriage, then you would be good enough to have a good Christian husband. And for me, who was in this really dysfunctional family environment, we have abuse going on. We have financial abuse going on. There's emotional stuff happening. There's a lot of volatility involved with the sex offender registry. There's just constant stress. I was looking for escape through school. I was looking through escape through marriage. So I was like, I am going to save my first kiss until my wedding day. And that was my goal for a long time. When I got around high school age, I got put into public school for the first time. Also during that time, I really started doubling down on the schoolwork because around that time, they really start pushing college. And for me, the message that I got there was, if you go to college and if you get into a good school, then you can make it out of this volatile situation. And I knew that I wanted to do that. So I really put my pedal to the metal trying to be able to go to a good school and get out of the situation that I was in. Another really interesting part of that was just starting to go to classes for the first time, interacting with other kids. I think the hardest part for me, though, in the transition was making friends, because the evangelical subculture that I had grown up in, I was taught this is the only right way to live. And if you don't follow this path, then you're on a path to destruction. During this time, I started interacting with kids with different perspectives than mine, kids who called themselves atheists, kids who called themselves agnostics, kids who were queer. So going into high school, meeting new people, I really wanted to keep that first kiss. I got to about 16. My first two people that I dated, their moms both found out about my dad, and they quickly broke up with me. It leaves you in a state of really low self-esteem. So when I was 17, I started dating a guy and kind of felt pressured into the relationship. He kept on pressuring me to kiss him. I was like, I'm saving my first kiss until my wedding day. He was like, well, don't you like me? And I was like, yeah. I kind of lied. I was trying to make him feel better. We went to the library together and there was some bushes along this path that were behind. And he was like, well, if we both want it. And then he leaned in for that kiss. I was super confused at that time. The thing about purity culture is it's taught you that if you were pure, then you would be safe. But what actually would have protected me would be an understanding of consent. And that was not something that I had the language for until much, much later. There were several non-consensual encounters within that relationship. And I felt so much shame as a woman, because you have to understand that within this evangelical subculture that I was growing up in, men can't control themselves, is how it's framed. And it's the women's responsibility to control those and usually also lead the guy to God. But then that puts the responsibility on the woman and not for the man to actually control himself. So I was in this situation where I was feeling really bad for putting myself in that situation, but also feeling like we kissed. He has a part of me now. So I almost felt obligated to stay in this relationship. He has to be my husband. So I really tried to make him into this good Christian husband that I would have wanted. But really staying in that was not a healthy situation. But I hadn't been taught boundaries. I hadn't been taught consent. I hadn't been taught any of the tools to spot those red flags and to say no and get out of that situation. So it really put me in a vulnerable position. I got to college with all the shame about what had happened. About a year into college, I also discovered my bisexuality, which was another crippling shame on top of all of this. When I went into college in 2014, I met my best friend. And when I discovered my bisexuality for the first time, I felt so much shame and embarrassment after that. I wanted to die. And I went to his room. He made me a cup of tea and handed that to me and had a conversation with me during that time. And having that supportive friend when I had felt so alone for so long was such an important thing. Having that friendship with him really changed my views in a lot of ways. When I did come out to my dad in particular, I remember we were sitting on the porch and I was like, hey, Dad, I want you to know I'm bisexual, and I discovered this. He basically said, your sexuality is an addiction and you have to go to this addiction support group with me. I remember like sitting in that room and having to say this quote unquote addiction that I had that I didn't have. And the shame that was on me as a woman when my dad was still being praised for his ability to recover from these things. College was really filled with a lot of differentiation from my parents' beliefs and a lot of strain over that as well. There was a lot of manipulation that my dad did during that time to triangulate my mom and I against each other. Around that time, I also got in relationship with another person, similar to the first one. I felt pressured, and it seemed like whenever I tried to get away, then they would threaten suicide, basically, and I would feel manipulated into staying with them. I was in what I would call an emotionally abusive domestic abuse relationship and was causing a lot of strain between me and my parents. That relationship continued for around 3 years. Fast forward to the end of college, I was just constantly on edge all the time. That was pretty normal for me. And when that becomes your normal, it really attracts relationships where you feel that same kind of thing, because when you are constantly stuck in survival mode feels like home. And then I got out of college and my mom was like, you should come live with us. And I did. My ex was going to move there as well, so we would be together. Around a year passed, a bunch of crazy things came up and we did break up, thankfully. Fast forward later on, January 2020, my dad got arrested for the second time. He was arrested for virtually the same crime where he was chatting with people online, exchanging inappropriate pictures. But the person that he was chatting with ended up being an FBI agent, and they arrested him across the border in Tennessee for an event that my parents were attending over there. So my mom drove back. Somewhere along the way, as she was driving through these mountains, she had the wherewithal to stop by Wendy's, get a tray of Frosties, and then bring them to us. So we all got called down to have these Frosties. And as we're eating these Frosties, my mom announces, hey, just to let you know, your dad isn't coming back. And I remember all of us just sitting around. This big TV is in the center of this room. And this TV had really become a symbol for how my dad had changed. My dad had become a very different person. He would basically come home from work really tired and just sit in this chair and just yell at the TV and Fox News and what the liberals were doing about the gay agenda and all these sorts of things. We all don't have any emotion. And my brother just pipes up and is like, at least we don't have to watch Fox News anymore. The TV comes up because there was a lot of anger towards the TV because we couldn't direct it towards my dad, because if we directed that anger towards him, then that would be keeping him accountable. And that's not something that was allowed to happen because he was at the head of the household. And that would be disrupting the authority dynamics. I was also living at the home at the time, and suddenly I was the only adult who had enough income to be able to contribute to the house. So I paid for my mom's rent for several months. I didn't make enough money to both cover the rent and be able to afford groceries and stuff like that. So we literally lived off of the goodness of the church and the church meal train for several months.
In January of 2020, Kate's father was arrested for a second time and charged with, quote, transportation of child pornography using a means of interstate commerce, end quote. In September of 2021, he was convicted and sentenced. Ultimately, he was given a sentence of a total term of 180 months. Kate's father's current prison sentence is projected to end in October of 2032. Upon being let out of prison, he will be on supervised release for the term of 15 years.
He got sent to federal prison. My dad started sending letters to us. And I remember his first letter was basically somewhere along the lines of, I found God in prison and God has forgiven me. So you need to forgive me too, and I hope for reconciliation one day. That was a really difficult thing for me to hear because I think there are several words in there that are used a lot in evangelical culture. One is forgiveness. And often this is used in abuse dynamics in particular. So I was really struggling during that time because I felt I was being pushed to forgive him. But I also knew that as soon as I said the words, I forgive you, the same dynamics were going to repeat. And I had gone through enough difficult things during college and that sort of thing that I knew I didn't want to have the same relationship with my dad as I did before. So I really started doing a deep dive into forgiveness because I felt a lot of guilt over not extending that to him. Basically, what I learned is that you don't have to extend forgiveness to an abusive person. I think forgiveness is part of a long grief journey. That takes a while, and you aren't holding a grudge if it does take a while. Forgiveness is really about loving yourself enough to say, I'm willing to let this go for the sake of myself and my story and wanting to move beyond this. And that took a long time to get to. So I didn't talk to my dad for about a year. I did read his letters. I did eventually move out during COVID. I did a lot of unpacking of faith baggage. That was around the time when a lot of people started deconstructing. It was like deconstruction was in the water.
Hey, this is Kevin.
This is Joe.
And Nick Jonas from Hey Jonas. This episode of Hey Jonas is brought to you by the all-new drink lineup at McDonald's.
I don't have to tell you that there are already so many great drink options at McDonald's, mm-hmm. but the new drink lineup, I mean, it takes things to another level.
They've got delicious caffeinated refreshers like the Strawberry Watermelon Refresher, crafted sodas like the Sprite Berry Blast, and now the all-new Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer.
We're talking about a total game changer. It's made with Red Bull. It's mixed with blue raspberry flavor and topped with freeze-dried dragon fruit.
Wow.
McDonald's has given us a refreshing new boost for your day.
And the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer is arriving just as you're heading back to the dorms for the fall semester. It's got a boost of energy and a kick of flavor when you need it the most. You know, powering through those lectures and studying sessions, you're gonna need it. Kicking the afternoon slump or rallying for the weekend.
Try one of the many new drinks like the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer, also available with Red Bull Zero, now at McDonald's.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
You know when people try a new food and suddenly it's like, wait.
That's the reaction a lot of people are having when they first try Kewpie mayo.
It's the one with the red cap and the little baby on the bottle. You've probably seen it in the grocery store before.
And if you've ever just walked past it, some people would say that's a huge mistake.
Because this mayo is different.
Most mayonnaise uses whole eggs. Kewpie only uses egg yolks, which gives it this rich umami flavor. It's smoother, deeper, and almost buttery.
Once people try it, they start putting it on everything.
Egg sandwiches, fries, burgers. Some fans even swear by dipping pizza crust in it.
And once you notice it, you start seeing it everywhere.
Chefs use it. Restaurants use it. People who really care about flavor use it.
Never tried it? Grab the bottle with the red cap next time you're at the store.
Put it on just about anything.
Then you'll understand.
Kewpie, the original Japanese mayonnaise.
Before my dad was arrested, I started dating someone. I later moved in with them. Then we later got married. And after we got married, I started experiencing a bunch of health issues. And I had been talking to my dad for several years. And I realized that I thought he had gotten past a lot of the dynamics in our relationship that were unhealthy, but they really weren't changing. And he wouldn't be able to get the help in order to change them for a long time. That started a whole journey of reconnecting to my body because during that time, I realized I had been dissociated for a long time. So it was really a process of reconnecting to my body in a lot of ways and starting to do meditation, starting to reconnect and journal and talk to my inner child. And I realized that I really need to change things in my life. I needed to learn how to set boundaries. I needed to have different relationships with people. I also needed to grieve both what had happened to me and my relationship with my dad, because by that point, I realized that the person that I knew from a long time ago, that they weren't a safe person and that they weren't going to be a safe person until they had the resources to be able to work on themselves, or maybe never. I remember my dad, we were having a conversation where I was basically saying, like, I need a break and I need to think these things through. And he said, well, I'm not evil, but I think when we put people in these binary categories, it keeps us in relationship thinking like, oh, maybe things will get better. And shifting from that to, is this person safe? Do they have safe dynamics that are going to keep me and my body and my mind and my spirit healthy? Or do they have unsafe dynamics that aren't going to change? Those sorts of things was a real shift. And to be able to say, my dad has done some terrible things. He has not been fully accountable for those things. He justifies or minimizes those things. And that is why I need to set boundaries and step away from this. And I want to talk a little bit about ambiguous grief here, because I think if you go to the grief section of the bookstore right now, 99.9% of the books are going to be about grief after death. Going through the process of estrangement with my dad was the first time that I realized that there's a different type of grief, and it's called ambiguous grief. And it could be grief over your body doesn't have the ability to do the same things anymore. It could be grief over a relationship. It could be grief over anything that isn't a death. That was a really important term for me because it gave me language around it. Anger is such an important part to let out in order to get through the process of grief. And really learning to express all of those emotions as you reconnect with yourself. Grief isn't just you're sad all the time. It's also fear of losing someone. It's hope. It's anger. It's finding joy again. Really going through all those feelings. And I think when we're so focused on forgiveness and reconciliation and that hope that someone else will change, we really lose out on the transformative process of grief. And during this time, I was doing trauma therapy as well. I still am. That was a really important support process. But it was also really difficult going through all those things at once. I really noticed a big shift in myself from a caretaker to a much more creative person, a much more free person, and just being able to find my voice and find this new identity within myself that felt much truer to who I was. There was a point in the springtime where I went to a lake near my house. And I remember sitting by that lake. I had exchanged several letters with my dad during that time and made the decision that I can no longer be in relationship with him. And writing, I had made the decision to protect my joy and peace, and I wish you the same in your life. With ambiguous grief, there isn't really a ritual to mark the end, so I made my own. I took the end lines of The Fox and the Hound, in my heart a memory, and there you'll always be. And I took the end line of that song, and I made that into a little boat, and I went over to the edge of the lake, and I dropped that little boat in, and I just watched it go into the sunset. I remember watching it and listening to that song over and over again so that I could cry and really mourn that moment. Because even though I'd had an abusive dynamic with my dad, even though he was fully accountable for what he did, we grieve someone because we had a love for them. I think estrangement feels like literally making the decision to cut off your arm. I think just getting to the point where you can validate yourself and saying, this happened. It was real. I have made the effort to try to get accountability for this. I know so many kids who are adults now who just try so hard to have their pain validated and have that relationship with another person. And eventually it can just become too unsafe. I think in terms of changes to the criminal justice system, I think I am in a very unique position where I am both someone who has survived sexual abuse, I've survived domestic abuse, I've survived child abuse, and I have also lived on the sex offender registry. I want to be really clear, because sometimes people assume that if you are critiquing the sex offender registry or parts of the criminal justice system, you're defending offenders. And that is absolutely not what I'm doing. I think people should be held fully accountable for what they did. But I think my concern with the registry, as someone who has lived on it as a child, because it was so isolating, because it put so much financial strain on our family, housing strain on our family, and the rules about where you and your family were allowed to go together. And because of some of the child protection policies around things like homeschooling, 48 states allow sex offenders to homeschool their kids. And a lot of the co-ops that we have, they don't have really useful child protection policies. So there are things baked into those dynamics. And I think that's an important thing, because I think when we look at the sex offender registry, we need to be thinking at more of like, how can we make this a survivor-centered registry and a child protection-centered registry? And then evaluate those policies, not out of fear, but actually if they make all children safer and support survivors and reduce recidivism and prevent future harm. So I want to be clear as I'm talking about this. My father is fully responsible for the harm that he caused. But I think we also have to be honest about the ways that our systems can create additional harm. We have this idea of sex offenders, of stranger danger, is much more of a probability. I think we see this in the news every day. It's going to be your youth pastor. It's going to be someone in your church. It's going to be someone that you know. We need to recognize that in order to protect children, in order to protect survivors. I think we need more support safety nets in order to better protect women and children and give them the safety that they need to leave, rather than asking, why didn't she leave? I don't come to these conclusions lately. I come to them because I've lived inside the consequences, but on my mind, my body, and my spirit. Advice that I give for people who are going through this is, I think the number one thing is get to a place where you and your body can feel safe. I think the next step is learn everything that you can. I think knowledge is your friend and your support during all of this. I think the next step after that is, once you're in a safe place, I think it's easier to start processing the grief. I think you can process that in a number of ways. Trauma therapy was very helpful for me. Talk therapy has been really helpful for me as well. But I think when we're talking about trauma dynamics in particular, sometimes that can re-traumatize you. Going through that grief process and using that grief to refine your creativity, what your values are, what you like, what you don't like, and really returning yourself is such a powerful, important part of this healing process. I have a blog on Substack called Quips and Confessionals, where I write as a bi evangelical pastor's eldest daughter for recovering church kids and for those rebuilding their life after survival. And I do essays on purity culture, estrangement, shame, and creative rebirth. And I also like to throw in a bit of humor there, because one thing that I've learned about humor is that humor takes the power out of what happened to us. It makes trauma easier to deal with. I'm also on Instagram, TikTok, Threads, at Kate Johnson Writes as well.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your process, your journey. Your transparency is really important. Thank you for doing what you do.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
I look over on his side of the bed and there's his laptop, which was not unusual. He was sometimes working on something for work before bed. I really am very trusting, but I picked up his computer and I open up a file and I find at least a dozen videos in this file and I start watching them. And what I come to realize when I watch this video is that I am drugged. His computer is in the closet and his computer is filming. At that point, I'm going into shock, of course.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production, co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.